Venerable Camus from the GTA.
In Sri Lanka, they ordain, many monks ordain, and they put the village of the monk before, so you might have many, you'll have many kundanyas now. So we'll have, you know, Colombo Kundanya, so we can call you GTA Kema. So Venerable Kema is a samanera, and we have two levels of novitiate. We have the Anagarika, samanera, and then the fully ordained bhikkhu, and it's a way that we, if someone wants to ordain with us, it's a way of training. So it's quite a slow progression to become a bhikkhu. So he's a good companion. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputtassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputtassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputtassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's nice to sit in a chair. So I just share with you the things that I find useful. And these teachings are for reflection, so if it doesn't fit, if that doesn't fit, don't wear it. And that, again, the capacity to reflect on a teaching is a very special human quality. I think I notice people who don't have that reflective capacity, who either believe or disbelieve, they really struggle with Buddhist ideas, because they can use them as kind of positions, not self as a position. It's all suffering becomes a position, and that is not really using the reflective mind. So sometimes, like the word suffering, dukkha, it sounds like Buddhism's sort of a Murphy's Law teaching. You know Murphy's Law, right? You all know that if you have a piece of toast and it's buttered and jammed, right? When it falls, it will invariably fall on the jammed side. That's Murphy's Law. So some people think that Buddhism is saying that all of life is Murphy's Law, right? Or there's a corollary that if something bad can happen, it will happen in the worst possible way. But that's not what dukkha is about. There is that aspect of life. But dukkha is really pointing to that which is unsatisfactory, and it has a deeper meaning. It's used in many ways. Dukkha is used in three ways, actually. It's used in just in terms of our sense experience having both attractive qualities and unattractive qualities. And that, when we use the word dukkha, that's dukkha vedana. And vedana, as we chanted this morning in the five khandhas, is one of the ways, one of the aspects of consciousness of human experience, which the Buddha emphasized is very important. We translate it as feeling, but feeling has a much broader perspective or sense, translation, much broader perspective in English, because it can mean emotional tone and so on. But here, vedana, the word vedana, it's good to perhaps use that, is just the sense of the kind of all sense experience, whether it's emotion or physical, has a sense of being, you're kind of drawn to it or repelled by it, and a variation of strength in that, like a spectrum. So I look at it as more like magnetism. There's polarity, like you're drawn to something in a very, very passionate and strong way, or in a very sort of half-hearted way, or repelled by something very, very strongly, or sort of annoyed by it, and a neutral zone. And so that's called, when it's the negative part of that sense experience, we call it dukkha vedana. So it's translated as unpleasant. So today you experience sukha and dukkha. Sukha is the other. So you maybe ate blueberry pancakes this morning. It's not something we get often in the monastery. That for me was sukha vedana. And then my knees were dukkha vedana. So that's just a very normal part of sense experience. It's a very, very important part of the way the Buddha laid out the constructs of consciousness, because with dukkha vedana, what you have is craving. Craving arises from that. I want the pleasant and I don't want the unpleasant. So it's very, very important concept to get to remember in the explanation that Buddha talked about in terms of suffering. Then we have dukkha in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So here we recited the Dhammacakka Sutta together, and that's dukkha as a noble truth. And it's noble because if you are willing to engage it, it leads to the cessation of suffering. It's not noble if you only have the First Noble Truth. So perhaps the existentialist had the First Noble Truth, but they didn't really get the Buddha's teaching. So if you read the play, Kamu or something like that, Ebola, that's not what the Buddha taught. And he taught Four Noble Truths. But so that's Adiyasaccha, or Adiyasaccha Dukkha, that there is this noble truth of suffering. And that's more like when any kind of discontent arises, it's very important to make that conscious, to understand it, to stand under it, to let it come into consciousness, because that leads to understanding how to let go of it. So that's the noble truth of suffering. And then you have Lakkhana Dukkha. Lakkhana means characteristic. And that refers to a very fundamental teaching, which you've all heard, is that the characteristic of the khandhas, the characteristic of the mind-body experience, the characteristics of that is that which has the nature to arise has the nature to cease. That's anicca, lakkhana. That's the characteristic of change. So if something begins, it will end. That which is born, it will die. That which has a beginning has an end. And then if that which begins ends in that changing phenomenon, you can't find any kind of essential person or self or soul. That's called anatta lakkhana. You've all heard this. And then dukkha lakkhana is that because it is that way, you won't find the unconditioned in that. So it's unsatisfactory. But it's unsatisfactory in terms of the Buddhist realization of enlightenment, the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the island, the refuge, the harbor, peace, freedom from suffering. So when we talk about dukkha lakkhana, it's just saying that even though you might really feel happy, be careful. It's not to put down happiness, but be careful, because happiness has a limitation. So its characteristic is dukkha. And this gets people very confused. You know, when you say to someone, sukha is dukkha, what is he talking about? You know, so it sounds so negative. But we all know that, don't we? You get kind of really excited by something, and you lose it, and then you get burned by it. And everyone's been through that one. And you realize that, yeah, happiness, okay, it's all right, but is there something which is deeper than sense happiness? And the Buddha says there is. There is a peace which is deeper than sense happiness. So one sees the limitation of sense happiness, and that's called dukkha lakkhana. So we say sukha vedana has the characteristic of dukkha lakkhana. I hope that's not too much. Huh? But it's very important to get that in Theravada Buddhism, to get some of these ideas clear in your head, because it can, if you take it wrong, if you really think that Buddhism is just this kind of negative negation of beauty and happiness and things like that, you can really misunderstand the thrust of teaching, what the Buddha is pointing to. So the point of the Buddha's teaching is his enlightenment, the point of our ordination. When we take the robe, we actually have it in our chanting, is that we ordain for the realization of Nibbana. And so that's a pretty loaded word. Nibbana is a pretty loaded word, and it's so misused now. Nirvana in the Sanskrit, no longer Nibbana. So you have Buddha bars and Nirvana perfume, I think, right? So it's a pretty useless word to some extent. But you also have words like the island, the refuge, the harbor, peace. You have language like that too. So the reason the Buddha teaches, it comes from that realization. And I think for me, obviously I talk a lot about this, and that's why I got into this business. I'm often, most people sometimes ask, they want to ordain, and I've just been contemplating why people ordain. Sometimes they want to be with a teacher. Sometimes they want to be with a community. They usually don't come for lunch. or they want, you know, some kind of security, you know, or they can't find work, something like that. None of that's a very good reason. Not a very good. To want to be a part of the community is not a very good reason. To want to be with a particular teacher, I think, not good enough. To want to realize Nibbana, to want to be a monk for the aspiration of Nibbana, then I'm interested. But if they say want to be in the monastery just because of me, I say, dodgy. I'm very unsatisfactory. Because it's not a very good reason, is it? Because those things are tenuous. They're not really solid. So the aspiration to Nibbana, a lot of people tell me, well, I'm not interested in enlightenment, I just want to be a bit happier. Yeah, so do I. The beauty of this teaching, it's both good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Because all the aspects of the teaching produce good results. Good morality produces good results. Generous living produces good results. Responsible living produces good results. Calming the mind produces good results. It's all good. There's nothing bad in it. But I think for me, if I didn't have that understanding of why the Buddha taught, I think it'd be very hard to comprehend a lot of these teachings: dependent origination, the three characteristics, just the word dukkha. It'd be very hard to comprehend, because I don't think I wouldn't have a sense of the reason for the teaching, where it's coming from. Because if you understand where it's coming from, then you understand why he lays it out the way he lays it out. So do consider that, like the Buddha, this phrase that I've always been encouraged to contemplate from Lompo Sumedho: there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the deathless. There is the island. There's the refuge, there is peace, there is the end of suffering. And this, and if there was not that, there would be no escape from the conditioned, from the formed, and from birth and death. Now, if you are a card-carrying Buddhist, you might believe in rebirth. Right? But if you're a bit dodgy with that, you might think, well, I don't really believe in rebirth. That's fine. That's fine. Because what we're talking about is not something that you have to speculate about. And the beauty of this is that you don't have to believe this, but you have to have faith to think, well, there's a possibility. You don't have to believe in something that you can't prove. This you can prove. So even beings who are enlightened don't necessarily have the psychic powers to check out what rebirth is about. So it's very grounded in present moment reality. We chanted the Dhammacakka Sutta, or we recited that. That's a good thing to do. Because sometimes people don't go to the old sources, and they get commentaries on commentaries and commentaries, and they'll retreat. You know, it's just kind of one little aspect of it. But just to go over that sutra is good for at least one lifetime. You just kind of go back to it again and again and again. It's amazing how it just reminds you and deepens your insight. And I always say that, don't I? I always say that the accumulation of knowledge is different than the use of some knowledge for deep understanding. So I'm sort of concerned about depth rather than breadth, because the teachings are vast, aren't they? The Pali Canon, they're great, they're vast. But to take something which strikes you as profound and then to keep honing that, keep going deeply, is the use of the teaching in a more and more profound way. Today I was suggesting just this idea of resistance. Very simple theme, nothing complicated, and yet one can see that if you take on board a theme like that, whatever happened today, whatever happened in your meditation or as you were walking around with the world and having your meal and so on, whatever happened, if you can carry something like that, just a kind of deeper, a more fundamental consideration of your conscious experience, is very insightful. It's very insightful, because the things, the particulars that I might resist, bodily aches, certain mental formations, a person flushing the toilet in the middle of the night, or really interesting things like that. a great note there. but just the resistance, right? And that what that does, it takes you out of the particular of your ego, and it takes you into the general called the Dharma. Right? So, like our personalities and our personal karmas are very particular. The memories I have and the bodily sensations I feel are mine. Yours are different. But this more kind of general investigation of resistance, we all have that. We all resist things. And so the Four Noble Truths are doing that. They're taking one of the genius of this teaching for me is he takes human experience, right? The different types of human experience we have, and he manages to get this down in a way that we can all contemplate it. It all, for me, I think this is all relevant. And he also takes the most unwelcome part of human experience, dukkha, unpleasantness that we have in various ways, and he uses it for enlightenment. That's brilliant. That's a genius. Rather than prettying up life, life is just wonderful. Just let go. It's great. But it's not. It's a hassle. It hurts. Sometimes you're happy. So this going from the particular to the general is looking at stream of consciousness. In the particular, when we talk about the teachings, we talk about usually morality, social responsibility, expression, generosity. That's the way we live our lives, according to moral principles, with compassion, trying to be responsible in our lives, and trying to be generous with the resources we have. So that's lifestyle. And that's the monastic rule that we have, the Vinaya. It defines the particular way that we live, the conventions that we live by. It defines our hierarchy, and it defines the way we use resources and the way we share resources. It defines the way we eat from our bowls, the way we receive alms food, the way we clean our kutis, the way we bow, the way we put our robes on, and so on and so forth. Legal procedures, how to deal with recalcitrant monks, or how to burn a body, all kinds of neat things. And that's the convention that we live by. And those are the particulars. But then, and that's called the Vinaya. Now, the lay people weren't given the Vinaya. Lay people were suggested the five precepts, living within responsibility. So all of us have the convention that we live by. So if you're a doctor, or you're a retired librarian, or you're looking for work, or you have a lot of people that you are in charge of, or you're a solo worker, or you just play golf all day, whatever, whatever you do, you have a kind of conventional life. And we try to do the best we can with that. But then there's also stream of consciousness, and that's what we can do on a retreat. We can observe stream of consciousness because the conventional structure is given. That's one of the beauties of a retreat. You may not like it sometimes, you know, you may like shorter sittings, longer sittings, later breakfast, earlier breakfast, but you can watch that. You can watch liking and disliking, and that's the freedom. So monastic life is a bit like a retreat life. It's more ordinary than retreat life, but the freedom of monastic life is not the freedom to change the structures, but the freedom to watch within a structure. And that's the same on retreat. You know, we're not given the option to just everyone, you know, we have a vote every morning what we should do. Wouldn't that be awful? How long should we sit? We don't do that. We just have the freedom, surrender to it. Okay, watch what happens. So, and then we watch stream of consciousness, and stream of consciousness is whatever presents itself to your mind. And then, within that, we watch the Four Noble Truths. We contemplate the Four Noble Truths. And I was suggesting just to do that, just to watch resistance. So whatever resistance might come up, what is it like? What does it really feel? And you can see that if I can have enough, if my contemplative mind is strong enough, remembers that, then I go beyond the particular, the person that I'm irritated with, or the particular mindset which I try to get rid of. What is resistance? What does it feel like? What is it really like? And that leads to the contemplations of the Four Noble Truths. So there is suffering. Suffering has to be understood. Suffering has been understood. There's the cause of suffering. This cause has to be abandoned. And the cause is attachment to sense pleasure, attachment to the craving to annihilate, attachment to the craving to become. The three kinds of cravings. So those are very important in the teaching. Craving to become, craving to get rid of, and sense pleasure. Hedonism. And all three, you get preoccupied. If I'm sitting here trying to, like, one of the insidious things that happens in for any meditative monk, and I'm sure it happens to you if you've been working at this for a while, is trying to get something. Trying to figure something out, trying to have an insight, trying to manufacture something, like even metta bhavana. And people will do metta practice and try to get this feeling of the heart, whatever, from before or whatever. So try to manufacture something. Try to understand what suffering is. You know, trying to, this mind, I was trying to get something out of it. And that's bhava tanha. That's a craving to become. Its grossest manifestation is just fantasizing about going to the Caribbean next week. Okay, that's fun. And then the bell rings. It's certainly. So, you know, you gotta, well, I didn't come here for that, did I? So just identifying that. Just identifying this is becoming. Is a big step, because then, rather than saying you shouldn't fantasize about Caribbean, you say, oh, becoming. So you generalize it again. You come to you go away from the particular. If you're in the particular, you think, oh, I shouldn't be thinking about the Caribbean. You're back in the particular, me not thinking about the Caribbean. You're not seeing stream of consciousness. But if you just notice, oh, I'm fantasizing about a nice vacation. Oh, fantasizing is becoming. You see, one of the basic causes of suffering is attachment to that, and you and the teaching begins to resonate in your mind. The third noble truth is that this craving has to be abandoned. That's the second noble truth, has to be abandoned, has been abandoned. The third noble truth is the cessation of craving, the cessation of suffering has to be realized. Now, when you notice the mind is fantasizing about the Caribbean. And let's say someone coughs, and you notice that, and you watch that cease, that's the third noble truth. The cessation of suffering, or the abandonment of craving, has been realized. if you don't try to get rid of it. If you try to get rid of it, you're back into craving. So that's why we emphasize the gap between thoughts, the space after a thought. So fantasizing about the Caribbean, and then someone coughs, and I notice, oh, that's an object of mind. That's something that's changing. And I'm back with Buddha knowing Dharma. And if I just rest with that, then the teaching says, realize that, make a note of that. This is important. This is really important. This is the path. This is the third noble truth. So the cessation of craving has to be realized, and it has been realized. Realize it right there. Now obviously there are deeper aspects to the cessation of craving. It's deeper and deeper, but that moment is the moment of the third noble truth. Nirodha, cessation. Right there. And then don't try not to add something into it. You don't have to add anything there. You don't have to become someone who's not thinking about the Caribbean, because then you'll try to become someone who's not thinking about the Caribbean, and you'll be thinking about the Caribbean. That's what happens. The more you try to suppress thought, the more thought comes up. Right? So it's a moment of non-commentary. I mean, you can say that, but you just notice it. It's a moment of cessation, and it's also a moment where the sense of self isn't manifesting. It's just purity. Pure presence. And that's a very, very important moment. Very important. I think all of us have not, you know, taken us a while maybe to see that, where cough comes and we notice we're thinking about Caribbean. It's getting boring, this Caribbean. I have to go somewhere else. And then we apply ourselves to the meditation object to get rid of the thinking. And that doesn't work. That's still craving. And we don't notice it. We have good intention, so we try fiercely, but actually we're still into craving. So then that's vibhava tanha. That's the craving to get rid of, to annihilate. So the extreme of that is, of course, suicide. That's the extreme of vibhava tanha, where one thinks life is just not worth living, and let's just end it all, annihilate it. And those are very, very sad things in human consciousness. And the lesser parts of them can be like really terrible, terrible feelings of just not wanting this problem, this family, this work, this sickness, you know, whatever it is, this like very deep sense of, I don't want this, I just want to get out of here. And then minor variations of that is just trying to get rid of thought. So it's a whole spectrum of vibhava tanha. And so I was just suggesting the word resistance. Resistance will cover it all, right? From the extreme to the subtle. And so you can see with bhava, this whole becoming, you have to give it up. And that becoming might be worrisome, it might be pleasant, you might just be, you know, very worried about a job interview or whatever. Or maybe that's just, your habit is always to try to figure out everything in advance. It's like, I like to joke, is how many times have we lived the life we never lived? It's just constantly planning the next catastrophe, which never happened. So catastrophizing, is that a word that's used, right? That kind of thing. And those are habits of mind, and they're very much future becoming. So how do you let go of that? Well, you have to trust. You have to figure out your own upaya, your own skillful means. Just trust, present moment awareness. But at least for some period of time, to see that stream of consciousness, the khandhas, cannot be where you'll find liberation. It can only be an awareness of change. So at some point you have to somehow make yourself available to that deeper realization. Because if the mind is preoccupied with the future, there's no... You're not available, right? You're preoccupied. So those are very good, I think, very good concepts to bring forth. Availability. Just make yourself available. So if I try to figure out, well, how can I get rid of my tendency to always worry? I have to figure out how I can get rid of it. That's just still, you're still preoccupied. So take a simple list. Available. Something really simple. If you use simple language like that, It gets me, I don't know you, it gets me away from the complexity of my analytical mind. Always trying to figure stuff out. Just available, Watchful, very simple. Yeah. So you have bhava, vibhava. And then you have the sense craving is just the constant seeking of the pleasant and trying to get rid of the unpleasant. The kind of reactivity we have to pain and pleasure, which is also a preoccupation. So that's why, like, just noticing the unpleasant as unpleasant, the pleasant as pleasant. So what we're trying to do is then come to those sort of ideas that maybe that like Eckhart Tolle gives in The Power of Now. It's interesting, he went to Amaravati for a couple of years before he went to Vancouver and had his enlightenment experiences. And Lompo Sumedho, there's a lot of language here in Eckhart Tolle when I hear Ajahn Sumedho's language. But when Ajahn Sumedho saw that book, he says, that's a good one, Power of Now. Should have got that one. I think we're in the same business, right? You get these really neat phrases, which are very succinct. But consider that when there is a craving to get rid of or become, or when there's preoccupation, that deep sense of resting in the present moment is not possible. If there's resistance, the mind won't settle. If there's becoming, the mind won't settle. If there's just preoccupation with sense pleasure, or then the mind will just stay agitated, it won't settle. So how do you settle deeply into the present moment and sustain that for long periods? It's by abandoning the craving, by abandoning craving. So we look at the very tendencies that we have not to stay in the present moment. What is it? What is it about my particular conditioning which finds that difficult? And then figure out ways to stay in the present moment in a deeply present, attentive way. And there's different ways that is we lose it. We get sleepy and fall asleep. We just get restless and keep looking at the clock, and fantasize, and so on and so forth. And those are all the kind of challenges we have. But if you understand the principle, or at least this is the way I see it, is this developing the capacity to be deeply present for long periods of time, which isn't an attainment, it's more like a training. I see it more like riding a bicycle. If you look at it as an attainment, then bhava tanha. And that will condition vibhava tanha. But if you see it as a training, then at any moment you can wake up and say, watchful, available, get a feeling for that, balance, pick up the object of meditation, whatever you like, and then ride the bicycle. And then you hit a tree, and get up, straighten the wheels, and then balance again. So if you see it as a training rather than as an accomplishment, then you'll get out of bhava tanha. If you see it as an accomplishment, then you're always trying to get it. And it's nothing you have to get, it's just more something that it's always here, it's remembering. Being watchful and available is possible with ugly states of mind. You can feel really ugly things, beautiful things, difficult things, easy things. They're all possible to be aware of them as something that changes. All right, I'll leave that for your consideration.
Handmayang dhamma kataya sarukarang dadama se sadhu sadhu sadhu.